As this is our last show during April Earth Day Month, we bring you this segment on agriculture and the environment, the politics of food. We begin with Red Eye Co-op interviewing a farmer about organic and local agriculture.
The big boxes of the suburban landscape are embracing organic. The most recent evidence is that over 600 McDonald's across the northeastern United States are going to be serving Newman's Own organic coffee. But local food producers say that we need to look further than the organic sticker on our food and think about where it comes from and how it was grown. Rebecca Neen is an organic farmer and brewer. She's co-owner of Cranogue Ales on Left Field Farms in the Shuswap region of BC. She joins me on the line this morning from her home. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning.
What are the limitations of simply buying organic in your view?
Well, if you simply buy organic without regard to the distance the food has traveled or who it's coming from, you could actually well be supporting some of the same people that have caused the caused major agricultural pollution and the destruction of our landscape in the first place.
And so what should we be thinking about when we see organic food?
Well, the first thing to think about is, where did it come from? Was it grown locally? Who made it? Who owns the company that, is purporting to be selling organic food? Of course, there's always the question of, is it actually organic? Is it certified organic or not? But mostly it's to look at your organic food choices, to look at your food choices overall, and to try to buy, instead of, say, the highly processed versions of food, whether it's organic or not, to start buying directly from the farmers or as close to the farmer as you can get.
And so if we see something specific like organic lettuce from California, what do we need to be thinking about with that?
Well, in part that depends on what time of the year it is. If it's summertime and you go to your grocery store and all you can find is organic lettuce from California, there's a problem. Why on earth should you be buying organic lettuce from California in any time between May and October when, you know, the Fraser Valley is full of local organic producers who are supplying the same product, generally at the same price, a great deal fresher without it having to have traveled several thousand miles. If you're looking at organic lettuce in February, then you might want to start asking yourself why you're choosing to buy organic lettuce or why you're choosing to buy tomatoes in February when they're not in season. And you could be making choices that reflect where you live and what people actually grow in this region.
And so if we're given the choice between local and non-organic or organic and from somewhere like California, should we choose the local?
Well, I hate to break out of the box, the big box here, but there's more than two choices. If you persist in buying from large-scale big box stores in a couple of years, that's the only choices there are going to be. We're not going to have the choice of buying from farmers, whether they're organic or not organic, that are local, because the big box stores will have returned all production to generally third world countries, and there will be no local option. So rather than simply stating this as a do we buy local non-organic versus buying non-local organic, I think we have to be a little bit more creative and start looking at ways that we can all, well, let me put it this way. You have a family doctor. Well, at least some of us do, at any rate. Why not have a family farmer? It'll keep you healthier in the long run. It'll keep your whole landscape healthier. And you can get away from the destruction, the wholesale destruction of both our economic system and our ecology that is offered by long-range, long-distance food, whether it's organic or non-organic.
And where should we go to find these producers?
Ooh, they're all over the place. I know of at least three weekly farmers markets in Vancouver. Now, you have to understand I'm not based in Vancouver, so I don't know for sure, but I know there's at least three. farmers markets every week in Vancouver where you can get directly in touch with farmers. There's a huge number of box programs like small potatoes or other box programs like that that actually deliver locally sourced organic groceries straight to your door. You don't even have to go to a store for these programs. You can go to a store if you want. There's a lot of local stores which will identify the farm that that grew the food that you're buying, or at the very least, where it came from, what province it came from, whether it came from out of country or not. And in fact, every store should be displaying this. It actually is the law. And you can also get directly in touch with local farmers through either through the farmers markets or through online databases like the one that's at certifiedorganic.bc.ca or through Farm Folk City Folk. And that way you can order directly from the farmer. You can save yourself a whole whack of money. You can get in touch with the local farmer and learn what it means to be eating seasonally. And you can save yourself the headache of having to go shopping every week.
Do you think we need another kind of certification that includes concepts like food miles as well as organic?
I'm not sure that another form of certification is really the answer. Whenever you get certification, I'm speaking as a certified organic producer, whenever you get certification involved, the whole point is to reduce the customer's own responsibility for finding out where their food is coming from and for making those decisions themselves. And I think, in fact, the answer is not simply to stick another label on it, but is for everyone to become just a little bit more involved in where their food is coming from and in the food system as a whole. Even if you're working, you know, a 16-hour day, you can come home to a beautiful box of groceries that actually has a message from one or two of the farmers enclosed in the box, and you get to know what's happening in your local community. And then maybe instead of going for a walk in Trout Lake one weekend, you'll actually take a walk out to the farm and maybe even potentially dig a potato yourself for the first time in your life.
So are there options for people who want to shop responsibly but don't have that much time to go shopping for groceries?
Well, I think the first option in that case is to sign up with one of the box programs. And the other is to work directly with some local farmer. Again, you can go through certifiedorganic.bc.ca. There's a huge database there of farmers, and it'll help you to get in touch with someone directly. This is especially good for things like meat, where you can buy locally, organically grown meat at extremely low prices when you compare to the store, and you know exactly what you're getting and where it came from. So I think your first two choices would be box programs or going directly to the farmer, and then after that, go to the farmer's market. It's a social event as much as it is a shopping event, and then finally, you know, go back to the grocery store.
And is there certain food that people shouldn't be eating at certain times of year? Like in February, should we actually be eating lettuce?
Well, in February, we should be thinking about foods that have been stored. Squash, carrots, beets, potatoes, frozen vegetables. There's lots of those available, and they're very high quality. They're minimally processed. Or if you need something fresh to eat, and I totally understand that urge, you want to try something like sprouts, which can be grown year-round without regard to the season. When we start eating unseasonally, like lettuce in February, tomatoes in February is a really huge one. I mean, for one thing, they taste vile. They taste like little round things made out of cardboard. They don't taste like tomatoes at all. Why should you subject yourself to that? Eat something that either has been grown seasonally or has been preserved, and you'll wind up with much better quality food, and you'll also wind up supporting your own local economy.
How do you know where food comes from?
You ask. I know.
And they have to tell you.
Well, in fact, your local grocer does have to tell you.
Okay.
That it is actually the law. And it's amazing that if you just sort of, you know, go into your local grocer and say, hey, you're supposed to be putting this sign on this food, they have to do it, and they will do it. It's not a big deal. Of course, if you're shopping, you know, directly and locally, and you're shopping at stores that already display that, you don't really have a problem. And when you're going to one of the box programs, they almost always tell you which farm, even, your food was grown on, not just what province it came from.
And so there is a legal requirement for all grocery stores to label where it came from?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why is it so important, in your view, to buy local? Is it more than just the fossil fuel use?
Yeah, it is. When you're buying local, you're supporting your local economy. You're supporting local farmers. You're doing a couple of different things. One thing, when you choose a local organic farmer, you're sending a very strong message to everybody else in the agricultural community. Not just that farmer, but other local organic farmers who say, hey, look at that, somebody else is purchasing our food, and this is okay. We are going to be able to make a living doing this. You're also sending a message to local non-organic farmers that, gee, look, our neighbor over there has got a whole whack of happy customers buying their food. They're getting a slightly better price for it. The customers are happy because they're not paying quite as much. Maybe we should think about growing organically. And, you know, maybe we can get away from all these cancer-causing crap we're spraying on our food. You're also, though, and it's a little more subtle, but what you're really doing is keeping your money in your own community. There's a whole bunch of studies. There's been some really excellent ones done in the UK, actually, about what happens to the money that when you spend it locally. If you go and buy a locally made product from a locally owned store, for example, 95% of that dollar stays right in your local community. And it, in fact, generates, not only does that money stay in your community, but it's actually generating more money within that community because that local, the local supplier has managed to stay open, the local retail store has managed to stay open, the people they're employing are still there. So you've actually enhanced your local economy by one little simple act of buying local food. In addition, when you choose not to buy, when you choose to buy at a big box store, not only does most of that money immediately go out of the community, you are in fact directly contributing to the loss of economic resources in your community, because the only money that stays in the community from a big box store is from the sub-poverty level wages that are being paid to local clerks. That's not a very good return on your dollar. So it's good for not only your local economy to be shopping locally, but it's also really important for local producers.
Well, thanks for speaking with me this morning, Rebecca.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with organic farmer and brewer Rebecca Neen. She's the co-owner of Cranogue Ales on Leftfield Farms in the Shuswap region of BC.
That was Red Eye Co-op Radio interviewing a farmer about organic and local food production. For information on farms and farmers markets near you, you can see www.localharvest.org. You're listening to Making Waves. Now we bring you labor news with two segments on the politics of food. First, about genetically modified food crops. Second, about food for children left behind.
This is Labor News. Information about most of us.
You can find us on the internet at labornews.us to listen to archived editions of our program. Coalition sues to stop another genetically modified disaster. The environmental news network, ENN.com, reports that a coalition of farmers, consumers, and environmental activists are suing the U.S. government over its approval of a biotech alfalfa that critics say will spell havoc for farmers and the environment. Opening another front in the battle over genetically modified crops, the lawsuit contends that the U.S. Department of Agriculture improperly is allowing Monsanto to sell an herbicide-resistant alfalfa seed while failing to analyze the public health, environment, and economic consequences of the action. The suit asserts that genetically modified alfalfa will probably contaminate conventionally grown alfalfa at a fast pace, ultimately forcing farmers to pay for Monsanto's patented gene technology, whether they want the technology or not. The group says biotech alfalfa would also hurt production of organic dairy and beef products, as alfalfa is a key cattle feed. And the suit claims farmers could lose export business, valued at an estimated $480 million per year, because buyers in Japan and South Korea, major importers of U.S. alfalfa, have indicated they would avoid buying U.S. alfalfa once the genetically engineered variety is released. In relationship to this issue, a farmer wrote to the editor of the Progressive Review at ProRev.com. Alfalfa is already an invasive weed. It will grow almost anywhere given a little water. Its seeds spread easily, hitchhiking with livestock and industrial travel. It could conceivably contaminate the planet in 3 to 5 years. It has hundreds of wild relatives in the pea family, such as clovers, peas, wild and domestic, beans, soybeans, lupine, trefoil, licorice root, medic, peanuts, lentils, cassia, and scotch broom, an invasive weed that creates extreme summer fire hazards. Monsanto, continues the farmer, is already aware of cross-species contamination from its GMO pollen pollution, particularly in plant families. As the most commonly farmed member of the pea family, look forward to Monsanto imposing its monopoly over the entire pea family in a few short years via genetically planted pollen pollution and theft by intellectual property rights. This is supposed to be the biggest theft of thousands of years of organic farming technology ever, dwarfing the damage done by runaway GMO corn and canola. It falls just short of patenting oxygen and charging us to breathe.
This is Labor News.
Food for Children Left Behind, a report from the Chicago Tribune. Hoping to stem persistent hunger and improve nutrition for poor children, the Chicago Public Schools and Greater Chicago Food Depository are sending kids home from school for the weekend with sacks of food. More studies are showing that children who don't receive adequate meals at home perform poorly at school, and officials are hoping their program will help reduce childhood hunger and thereby improve academic performance. There are many parents who just don't have the means to provide enough nutrition for the kids, and unfortunately there is a population of kids who just miss meals, said Mike Mulkin, executive director of the Food Depository. The program, named Nourish for Knowledge, is active in 16 city schools in low-income neighborhoods, although officials hope it is well-received by parents and can be expanded. About 2,460 Chicago school children received the sacks at week's end. Chicago school officials are making a concerted effort to make sure students are not suffering from hunger while they're sitting in school. About 273,000 city school students qualify for free or reduced-price meals at school. The district serves about 72 million meals each school year, including breakfast, lunch, and afternoon snacks. Last year, the district launched a summer program to provide full meals for children at more than 400 schools in low-income neighborhoods, regardless of whether or not they were enrolled in school. The school system found great demand, serving about 1.2 million meals through the summer. It's a recognition in the part of food banks and schools that many families right now are having trouble making ends meet in terms of their food budget, said Lynn Parker, director of child nutrition programs at the Food Research and Action Center in Washington, D.C. During the weekend, they know that when school meals aren't available, the children and their families are struggling financially and need the extra help. In the meantime, children are bombarded with tests that threaten schools with losing funds if students don't perform at a level set unilaterally by the federal government and parents continue to be laid off and forced to take up lower-paying jobs. Obviously, nowadays not only children are being left behind. This was Labor News. Information about most of us.
You're listening to Making Waves. We now hear from Jav Parrish from Pacifica Radio, speaking about our history and our future on May Day.
May Day returns to its roots. This is Jav Parrish. For many older Americans, May Day brings to mind images of Soviet soldiers goose-stepping through Red Square behind massive tanks while millions of onlookers obediently cheer. But May Day is an American holiday, one celebrated for the last century everywhere in the world except America, and one whose origins are well worth remembering, because May Day began as a strike for basic workplace rights we're now in the process of losing. That strike was largely by immigrant workers, which is exactly what America will see when immigrants and their supporters strike, march, and rally across the country on a National Day of Action for Comprehensive Immigration Reform this coming Monday, May Day. The first May Day, International Workers' Day, in 1886, began as a series of general strikes in Chicago and other Midwestern cities for the 8-hour workday. The strike took on particular significance when, 2 days later, police attacked striking workers on Chicago's South Side, killing 4 and injuring over 200. At a rally the following day to protest the police attack, a bomb went off at Chicago's Haymarket Square, killing 8 police. The bombing led to death sentences for 8 leading anarchists, including several German immigrants, convicted with no evidence at all for conspiracy to commit murder. The hostility to organized labor whipped up over Haymarket meant that, in turn, May Day became an international labor rallying cry for the right of workers to organize in general and for the 8-hour workday in particular. By the end of the decade, May Day was a holiday celebrated by workers and workers' movements in every industrialized country in the world. It took another entire generation of struggle, but by 1912, federal workers in the U.S. were granted the 8-hour day. And in 1917, while America was desperate for the cooperation of unions in the war effort, the 8-Hour Act became law. And there, one would think, the matter was settled. Okay, quick, do you actually only work 8 hours in a day? Only 40 hours in a week? 5 days? Not very many of us do. Not any longer. We stay longer in the office. We take work home with us. We take work everywhere with us. Nor do we get anywhere close to the vacation or sick day benefits workers get in other industrialized countries. And let's not even talk about health care coverage, which isn't even linked to one's workplace in most of the industrialized world. It's accepted as a universal need and right. Income for most working families in the U.S. isn't keeping up with inflation. And for all of these effective losses in compensation for our work, we're still working harder and longer hours than our grandparents. It's not too different now, really, from 1886, then as now. Big business was exploiting the desperation and relative powerlessness of cheap immigrant labor, and in the process, trying to depress the wages and establish exploitative precedents for all workers. Then, as now, much of the rest of the public feared and distrusted a part of the labor force that often didn't even speak English. Then, as now, the immigrants had finally had enough, and marched and struck. This Monday, the largest wave yet of immigrant marches and rallies will take place in scores of cities across the U.S. Their immediate focus is stopping proposed congressional legislation, but the larger context is America's corporate-friendly trade policies. The World Bank and the array of impenetrable global trade acronyms, WTO, IMF, NAFTA, CAFTA, and so on, have decimated economies in Mexico and other poorer countries, and those trade policies have spurred economic emigration to America, while at the same time exporting millions of better-paying jobs from America to poorer countries. The immigrant struggle is not just legal, but economic, and a matter of self-respect and self-preservation. It is, in important ways, the leading edge of a struggle all American workers are facing. On Monday, find the immigration march in your community. Join it. Get inspired. Happy May Day. From KBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Jav Parrish.
Here comes Dave Littman with I Hate Walmart. Don't forget to come and see Dave on Tuesday, May 2nd at 7 p.m. He'll be at the South Church at 292 State Street in Portsmouth.
I've always hated Blockbuster.
Target, McDonald's, The Gap, Pepsi, Nike, IBM.
Starbucks, not quite so much. If I'm not boycotting at least three oil companies, I start to feel out of touch. I wouldn't be seen in Nordstrom's or any such. And I hate Walmart. I don't like whips. I don't like chains. I don't go chopping up my neighbor's brains. Don't really even like shopping except at the flea market. I hate Walmart. Now you may wonder, what's all this fuss? If you don't like the train, take the bus. Well, I found religion, and just between us, I hate Walmart. If you didn't hear the story, well, here's how it is. Big company sell the low cost, drive mom and pop out of business. Pretty soon all over the land, one big square store, identical brand, and that's why. Things to buy and sell. Now it's all Taco Bell. I hate Walmart. Roll juice, dip and wine. You drive slow, relax your mind. Never knew what you'd find around the next bend. But now the freeway goes so straight, it go right past the pearly gate. I don't feel human, I feel like freight. I hate Walmart. I like to roam, I like to greet individuals on the street. But it tastes like it fell out of an airliner. It's enough to make you weep. I don't like board games. I don't like brand names. They make inflated claims. They're full of bleep. Everyone I meet is a high-tech killer. Wants to sell me a digital potato peeler. And I don't like Garrison Keillor, cause he's so white. Turn on my radio dial. Like to hear something new once in a while. But it's the same old crap in a brand new style. It's audio. I turn the dial, but always lose. They only play the worst rock and roll, and once in a while, if you're lucky, maybe one little rhythm and blues. And that's why God made tape. Used to be we wore beads and bells, made our own clothes in our own way. Now we all wear uniforms at Hard Rock Cafe. We're in a state of sartorial. In sales. Go grow your own, make your own. Be careful what you own. Develop non-shopping to an art. And whatever you do, don't shop at Walmart.
That was I Hate Walmart by Dave Lippmann, who will be playing this Tuesday, May 2nd at 7 p.m. at South Church in Portsmouth on State Street. For more info, contact 603-749-9159 or email info@seacoastpeacereponse.org. You're listening to Making Waves. And now we bring you Between the Lines, Independent Radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present James Ingalls, co-director of the group Afghan Women's Mission, who assesses growing violence and repression in Afghanistan. Tyson Slocum, with Public Citizens Energy Program, who discusses yet another wave of soaring U.S. gas prices and calls for an oil company windfall profits tax. And historian John Kayonis-Fadden, who examines the historical roots of a current land dispute that has triggered conflict in the Iroquois Confederacy in Ontario, Canada. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
FBI whistleblower Colin Rowley, who complained about her supervisor's inability to connect the dots before 9/11, is on another lonely road. She's seeking to oust Republican Congressman John Klein in the conservative-leaning 2nd Congressional District in Minnesota. True to form, Rowley is running an unconventional campaign. She's dismissing advice from political consultants to style her hair and to use her 2002 Time Person of the Year cover image with two other women whistleblowers in campaign literature. Instead, the whistleblower is relying on her guts and strong opposition to the war in Iraq. At first, Rowley resisted appeals for her to run for Congress, but she agreed to get into politics after President Bush passed over her nomination to the Privacy and Civil Rights Oversight Board. As Rowley told Mother Jones magazine, right from the start, you hear money, money, money. The whistleblower shocked the local political establishment last August when she went to Cindy Sheehan's anti-war encampment outside of President Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. On the stump, Rowley says Iraq is a hot-button issue in the Republican-leaning rural district, and she says she is the best messenger, a former career FBI agent and a lifelong Republican, until the Bush administration manipulated intelligence to justify the invasion of Iraq. Islamic Iran, a Muslim nation with an intolerant image, has crafted one of the world's most progressive AIDS prevention programs. The HIV/AIDS program walks a delicate tightrope between explicit talk about sex and respect for the teachings of the ruling Shiite authority. An Iranian can be flogged for drinking alcohol, but the government gives out clean syringes and methadone to heroin addicts. Moreover, government-run health clinics offer free HIV testing, counseling, and treatment. The Islamic government estimates there are 12,000 people in the Middle East country with AIDS, but HIV health workers say the number is five times higher. Tehran's coordinator for the United Nations AIDS program says they are passing out condoms and syringes in prison. This is unbelievable. In the whole world, there aren't six or seven countries doing that. AIDS advocates feared what would happen after the election of ultra-conservative President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. His health minister dismissed AIDS as a priority, and the education minister stopped printing AIDS pamphlets aimed at youth. But suddenly, the Iranian president publicly supported passing out methadone to addicts, and the innovative AIDS program came back to life. In a new alliance for clean energy, farmers who grow corn, soy, wheat, and even some dairy farmers are pushing Congress to look for new power sources directly from America's agricultural lands. The new campaign 25 by 25, which has the backing of mainstream farming groups, seeks to have a quarter of all U.S. energy come from ethanol, processed animal waste, and wind and solar power generated from farmlands. At the moment, these sources only provide 4% of the American energy mix. According to The Grist, an online environmental magazine, the initiative aims to merge the strong support for production of biofuels in the heartland and the support for renewable energy. Already, the campaign has won the backing of prominent conservatives like former House Speaker Newt Gingrich and Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, the former budget chief for President George W. Bush. Yet, some environmentalists remain skeptical. Greens worry that large-scale production of biofuels could lead to more monoculture crops like switchgrass that could threaten wildlife habitat and biodiversity. Others worry about the levels of pesticides, fertilizers, and fuel required to harvest the new energy-rich crops. As Nathaniel Green of the Natural Resources Defense Council observed, if these plans aren't drafted with sustainable guidelines, clearly that could be a problem. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
While much of the world focuses on the continuing bloodshed and chaos in Iraq, the ongoing conflict in Afghanistan receives comparatively little attention. However, a rocket attack targeting the U.S. Embassy in the Afghan capital of Kabul on April 19th is a reminder of the increasing number of recent attacks and suicide bombings by Taliban fighters across southern and eastern regions of Afghanistan. While the rocket attack missed the embassy and no one was injured, some Afghan civilians were not so lucky in a series of incidents in mid-April. 7 civilians were killed and 3 were injured in a U.S. airstrike in Kunar province on April 15th. 4 of the dead were children. In Khost, American soldiers shot and wounded 3 women and a newborn girl returning from a hospital on April 17th. A man and a 7-year-old boy were also shot and injured April 18th on the outskirts of Khost by U.S. troops. According to U.S. military officials, both incidents occurred when vehicles failed to slow down at checkpoints. Human rights groups are also decrying a deteriorating situation for women inside Afghanistan. The United Nations reports that during 2005, 300 girls' schools were burned down, while women's literacy is half that of men. 1 year ago, the Bush administration succeeded in eliminating the post of the UN's top human rights monitor in Afghanistan after he had criticized the U.S. military for arbitrary arrests, illegal detentions, and abuses committed by American-led forces. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with James Ingalls, co-director of the group Afghan Women's Mission, who assesses the growing violence and repression in Afghanistan.
The deaths that you've been hearing about recently highlight the disregard for the lives of the people that the U.S. military is supposed to be there helping. The fact that it's escalating is due to the fact that the U.S. has escalated the number of strikes that it's doing. I don't think it's changing in terms of the likelihood of killing civilians or not. But obviously, the U.S. is not as concerned about the civilian population as making a dent of some sort in the anti-U.S. forces there, which also are escalating their own attacks. The groups that are fighting the U.S. are getting a lot of support right now from the bordering provinces of Pakistan, which is right on the border with Afghanistan. So most of the activity that we're hearing about is taking place right on the border provinces, with U.S. forces attacking so-called militants in the bordering regions of Afghanistan, while in Pakistan, the forces that are attacking U.S. troops are getting replenished supplies and getting new militants that are coming in from Iraq. And the whole Al-Qaeda operation is in full swing once again. The recent killings of civilians by U.S. troops show that the anti-U.S. militants are very well blended into the population. And it may even imply that there's some degree of support by the population for these forces.
What's the relative stability of the government of Hamid Karzai, a U.S. ally who's installed as president, elected as president, and the role of the warlords there?
Mm-hmm. It's a very strange situation because Karzai is probably the least hated of all the government forces and anti-government forces and foreign troops in Afghanistan. I mean, he is kind of grudgingly supported by most of the people, I believe. They're slowly becoming more and more jaded with him. For example, when he ran for president, after he had been essentially appointed president by the UN and the U.S., and then he actually ran for president in elections, 70% of the population voted for him. So he was very highly supported, but that was because they thought he was implying that he was going to reduce the power of the warlords. And when he didn't do that, people are becoming more and more jaded. I mean, now a year later, a year after the presidential elections in autumn 2005, they had parliamentary elections. And in some places, like in Kabul province, which is where the capital is, where the most, you would think that the most kind of liberal people would live, only 30% of the population voted for parliament because they had realized that they can't really change anything by elections. Some of them were upset because a lot of the people running for parliament were warlords. And in fact, after the elections, about 50% of the parliament is known to be either warlords or extremist fundamentalists. The parliament is made up of a lot of people who are known war criminals. The stability of this kind of situation, it's too soon to tell how this is going to play out, because Karzai is playing a very interesting game, trying to act in what's perceived as the interest of some warlords and fundamentalists, but at the same time acting and doing other things in the interests of some more liberal people.
Well, James Ingalls, as you and our listeners I know read, Abdul Rahman was arrested for apostasy for his years earlier conversion from Islam to Christianity. He faced the death penalty. I believe he was released and charges were dropped, and immigrated later to Italy after a lot of pressure was exerted by the United States. Right. And many Christian fundamentalist groups and a broad range of organizations came out against this guy facing the death penalty for a simple conversion of his religious faith.
Right.
But on the other hand, as you wrote in your article, Selective Outrage, there's really a blind eye turned by the United States and our press and many religious groups against the horrendous subjugation and repression of women on a daily basis in Afghanistan, not to mention the horrendous situation for children and people in general in terms of health. And this is under right. a U.S. occupation. Say a few words about that, if you would.
Well, yeah, where is the outrage when the same justice system that had Abdul Rahman on trial, where is the outrage when that justice system allows the stoning to death of a woman who is accused of adultery in a remote province of Afghanistan? Where is the outrage when it allows the beating of women by their husbands? When it allows the threatening of journalists for criticizing the warlords or fundamentalists for what they called holy fascism? Where is the where is the outrage about the whole situation, as you said, for the extreme poverty that people still live under in Afghanistan? The U.S. is doing all kinds of elaborate schemes for attacking villages and tracking down terrorists, which they're not very successful at, but they're spending a lot of money on it, and they have a lot of person power put towards it, but very little has changed in terms of the average standard of living for most people in Afghanistan. Maybe some areas are slightly better off, and of course, there's no Taliban there, the Taliban are less of a force to be reckoned with, although they're coming back. But in terms of getting a job or finding a means of, a shelter, there's no outrage for that.
That was James Ingalls, co-director of the group Afghan Women's Mission. Contact the group by calling area code 626-676-7884 or visit their website at www.afghanwomensmission.org. In mid-April, gas prices in the U.S. skyrocketed 25 cents in just 2 weeks, bringing the average national price for self-serve regular to $2.91 a gallon, although prices topping $3 a gallon were common. President Bush, already reeling from record low approval ratings, felt the sting of intensifying anger across the nation about rising energy prices, announced his plan to rein in the cost of gas. The president said on April 25th that he'll ask the EPA to temporarily relax clean air regulations, which oil companies claim have caused gas shortages in some northeast states, delay deposits in the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve, ordered a federal investigation into possible gas gouging, and cut some oil company tax breaks. But consumers, well aware that energy companies like ExxonMobil reported the nation's highest ever profit of $36.1 billion in 2005, are suspicious of the president's cozy relationship with big oil. Republicans who control Congress received 81% of the $54 million in political campaign contributions made by big oil companies since 2001. But election year jitters are causing some GOP congressional legislators to join Democrats in calling for a probe of oil company profits and consideration of a windfall profits tax. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Tyson Slocum, director of Public Citizens Energy Program. He discusses some reasons behind the dramatic rise in gas prices and explains why he supports a windfall profits tax.
The energy traders in New York have pushed the price of oil above $70. And, you know, because gasoline is manufactured from crude oil, that's a big determining factor in the price of gasoline. But it's not just the Saudi royal family that gets rich when oil prices shoot up to over $70 a barrel. It's any big oil producer. And ExxonMobil and the other big oil companies are huge oil producers. I mean, ExxonMobil alone produces more oil than the entire Kingdom of Kuwait every day. And so combined, all of the big oil companies, including Chevron, Texaco, and ConocoPhillips, and BP, and Shell, they're all producing, you know, as much oil as most of the Middle Eastern nations combined. And so that's a big explanation as to why the oil industry is experiencing record profits. Because on average, it costs a company like ExxonMobil about $20 to extract a barrel of oil and deliver it to the market, whether that extraction is going on in Nigeria or Azerbaijan or Alaska or Texas. So it's costing them $20 a barrel, but they're selling it to the American public at $70 a barrel. To us, that is the classic definition of a windfall profit. They are earning huge amounts of money, not because of any new innovation or efficiency that they've introduced, but simply because the underlying value of the product has skyrocketed in price. And so that's why we are calling for a windfall profits tax on that huge windfall profit and dedicating the revenues from that tax to alternative energy and sustainable and renewable energy and mass transit systems and all sorts of things that will actually go towards solving America's energy crisis.
There's an explanation by the oil companies that goes something like this for the price spike. They say because of environmental regulations, many of the refineries are now reformulating their gas mixture to include ethanol. And therefore, the capacity has shrunk down. Therefore, less supply, the same or more demand, higher prices. What can you tell us about that explanation?
Enron did it during the California energy crisis, and now oil companies are blaming environmental laws for this shoot up in prices. Sure, we've, gotten rid of the polluting chemical MTBE, which was a gasoline additive that, companies like ExxonMobil were adding to gasoline to make it burn more cleanly. And we've replaced that with ethanol, and there's been some distribution problems. But that alone does not and cannot explain the huge increases in prices at the pump, nor can it explain the huge profits that the industry is making. And it's really important to note that the oil industry often tries to downplay their profits. They say, well, if you compare us to other industries, our level of profit is actually fairly average, which is probably the first time in corporate history that we've ever seen a corporation try to say that they are not a great investment. But when they're talking to Wall Street, they are using a very different measure of profitability. For example, in ExxonMobil's annual report, they say, look, you cannot look at profits as a share of our total sales. You have to look at profits as a share of our capital investment. And when you look at that measurement, ExxonMobil's profit margin globally in 2005 was over 30%. So they had a 30% rate of return on their capital investment. And in their U.S. oil production activities, they had a 46% profit margin. And on the U.S. oil refining, they had a 59% profit margin. So again, that shows to us that this industry is among the most profitable in the U.S. economy, and again gives us the ammunition to support a windfall profits tax on the oil companies.
Tyson Slocum, tell us a little bit about how a windfall profits tax would actually work, and What's the potential support for such a move in the Republican-controlled House and Senate?
For the first time in a very long time, the voices of the people are beginning to be a little louder than the campaign contributions provided by the oil industry. Remember, I mean, the big reason why the oil industry has been immune from scrutiny for so long is that since 2001, they've given $58 million in campaign contributions, with 81% of that going to Republican candidates. But I think for the first time, we're starting to see that even that kind of money that finances reelection campaigns, in at the end of the day, may not be able to trump the will of the people. And so it's just important for all the listeners out there to write into your senators and representatives and demand that they support a windfall profits tax and that the tax be dedicated to sustainable, clean energy investments and solutions that are going to get America out of this mess.
That was Tyson Slocum, Director of Public Citizens Energy Program. Contact Public Citizen at area code 202-588-1000 or visit their website at www.citizen.org. In late February, a group of Native people from the Six Nations, or Iroquois Confederacy, began an occupation of land in Caledonia, Ontario, Canada, where a construction company had started building a residential development. The Native people claim the land is theirs, while the company insists it has legal claim to the property. The occupation has attracted Native and non-Native supporters from other parts of Canada and become a focal point of the struggle for Native sovereignty in Canada. In mid-April, police arrested 16 of the occupiers who had blockaded some of Caledonia's streets. According to the local newspaper, up to 500 townspeople rallied on April 24th in opposition to the 8-week occupation. John Cahionis Faden is a member of the Mohawk tribe, one of the Six Nations. He grew up on the Akwesasne Reservation, which straddles the U.S.-Canadian border between upstate New York, Ontario, and Quebec. Faden is a historian and director of the Six Nations Indian Museum in northern New York. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Faden about the history of the land dispute, which he says dates from policies enacted by the British in Canada after the U.S. Revolutionary War. He notes that the Canadian government has now called upon the traditional chiefs and clan mothers in an effort to negotiate a settlement.
Going back to the Revolutionary War, there were some people who within the Iroquois who supported the British, and there were some within the Iroquois who supported the Americans, and there was a great number of them that wished simply to be neutral, and that was the policy of the Iroquois Grand Council at that time, at the beginning. But this war, of course, ranged up and down over their own territories, and they couldn't help but be dragged into it. And as a result of that, those who supported the British after the Revolutionary War ended, their territories were bound to be lost, and therefore they moved further west into this area of southern Ontario beyond Niagara Falls. And this was a huge, I think it was 988,000 acres of land. Those people that are there today are the descendants of those Six Nations people that went there following Joseph Brant after the Revolutionary War. But then through time, some of this good-sized tract of land was eaten up by various events that occurred. And then specific to this land here that is under contention right now, what occurred was that in, I think it's 1841, in the 1800s at any rate, there was this land transaction occurred. The Six Nations people feel that the land was leased to these non-native people. But then the non-native people claim that the land was sold outright, and that therein lies the contention. You know, what's the reason for the problem? Is that these Six Nations people feel that they still own that land. And why they got particularly upset and what created this situation is the fact that there was a company called Henco Limited, I believe, that they build houses, I think it was several hundred houses. Meanwhile, the Six Nations people, again, feel that they own that land, and so they went to court in 1990-something. And I really don't know the outcome of that, but I don't, or if there has been one. But it was like an injunction was put against the Indians who had set up their protest camp, and then an injunction was put forth by the Canadian government that they had to leave, and then they just simply refused to leave, and that's where we are today.
John Fadden, what's the latest information you have on the standoff?
Well, I keep getting reports, and some of them are just simply articles from Canada, and some are from Native people, and they don't all agree. But one of them claims that in a nearby city of Hamilton at the airport that there are hangars that have contingents of Canadian armed forces there ready to go. Now, whether that's a fact, I don't know. And that the police, of course, are still around. And I think one number that was used is about 1,000 police officers, including Ontario Provincial Police and RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Let's see, here's another historic fact, is that in the 1800s, the late 1800s, the Canadian government unilaterally created what's called an elective system. They abrogated the traditional system of the Grand Council of Chiefs and Clan Mothers. And then so they would only deal with the band council that they created. And, of course, you create a band council that you want to work with people that you're able to work with that will be more conducive to going along with what you say and want. And that's what happened just about in every reservation in Canada and in a good number in the United States. You know, they're like colonial governments that were created. But anyway, the traditional form of government based on clan mothers and the chiefs is still existent, as it is at Akwesasne and other places. But the ones who do most of the administering of various things that need to be administered is done by the band council. But my understanding is that what the band council, they've been dealing with this issue of this land protest, is that they're not able to follow through very well, and so that they've turned it over to the traditional government. And so that the Iroquois Haudenosaunee, or the Six Nations traditional government, is the one speaking with the officials who are there on the other side. And I think that's an interesting thing to have occur, is that they've, you know, gone back to the traditional government that the Canadian government tried to eradicate over a century ago.
That was John Cahionis Fadden, director of the Six Nations Indian Museum in upstate New York. For more information, email Fadden at redmaple@northnet.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.vtlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.yahoo.com. wireNH.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. As April ends, we leave you with this quote by Wendell Berry. You cannot save the land apart from the people, or the people apart from the land.